This is VOA Asia Weekend. From Washington, D.C., I'm Ari Arifin in for Ira Melman with a look back to the past week of news and feature stories that made up our daily VOA Asia program. The UN Children's Fund says climate change in Bangladesh is threatening the lives and futures of 19 million children, or one-third of all children under age 18 in the country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva on the UNICEF report, A Gathering Storm. Climate change clouds the future of children in Bangladesh.
The report forecasts a grim future for millions of children who live in Bangladesh's flood and drought-prone lowlands in the country's north and in the storm-ravaged coastline along the Bay of Bengal. They are the areas most likely to be devastated by floods, cyclones, and other environmental disasters. Included among the 19.4 million vulnerable children are nearly 500,000 Rohingya refugee children. They and their parents fled to Bangladesh's Cox's Bazar area to escape violence and persecution in Myanmar. They are living in fragile bamboo and plastic shelters, which will not be able to withstand a climatic disaster. The report's author, Simon Ingram, says climate change will have direct implications on children's lives, especially the poor, who are most at risk from its devastating impacts. He says more than 6 million climate change refugees have migrated from rural to urban areas. He warns many of the children who end up in Dhaka and other large cities are forced to fend for themselves.
Many children being pushed into very hazardous forms of child labor. Many girls who end up being pushed into taking early marriages because their families can no longer look after them. And there are other girls who also end up in what is clearly a flourishing and expanding sex trade in the cities. Girls who are left with simply no other outcome available to them.
Despite the magnitude of the problems ahead, Ingram says the children he met during a visit to Bangladesh are not fatalistic. He tells VOA they're very resilient and determined to take their future into their hands. He says more and more youth activists are coming to the fore and becoming agents of change.
In the report, you can read about one particular network down in the south of the country where there is something like 1,500 activists who go out to communities, helping people understand risks that face them, helping them basically get ready for whatever might be around the corner in terms of a climatic shock.
Ingram says this sort of work is expanding and getting the recognition it deserves. He says Bangladesh as a whole is pulling together to meet the climate challenge. The report is calling on the international community to support the government in implementing a range of initiatives aimed at shielding children from effects of climate change. It says children must be put at the center of any response. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Networks like Bluetooth connect our devices easily and effortlessly, but the area that these portable networks cover is big enough to make them hackable. Now, a group of engineers from Purdue has solved that problem by turning your body into a network. Kevin Enox explains.
More and more often, we're connecting things to our mobile devices via networks like Bluetooth. And most of these things, like smartwatches and fitness trackers, are attached to our body. But those Bluetooth signals extend well beyond arm's length. And Shreyas Sen from Purdue University says that makes them hackable.
It is becoming increasingly common to have smartwatches, fitness trackers, and even more wearable devices like head-mounted displays, etc. And all of these are interconnected using the body area network, where we are using the electromagnetic spectrum to communicate among these devices. People around the room can snoop on these signals and do malicious things.
The problem is that Bluetooth signals can extend from the body by as much as 10 meters, accessible to someone walking or sitting nearby. Sen and his team have turned the human body into a communication system that's incredibly secure because it only extends about a centimeter beyond the skin. It also uses nearly 100% less energy than traditional Bluetooth networks.
Our research on human body communication focuses on, for the first time, containment of the signal within the body. so that someone who is very close to the body but not touching the body cannot still snoop the signal.
The security implications are impressive. The system also imagines the future possibility of a simple wearable device doctors can use to monitor a person's health continuously, perhaps dispensing medicine or tweaking implanted devices like pacemakers.
I can see this changing humans' daily lives in terms of human-computer interaction or healthcare remote monitoring throughout the day. So the fact that I see a path of this technology impacting a wide variety of people in their daily lives is the most exciting part to me.
The Purdue team has multiple patents on their technology and is working with government and industry players to miniaturize their tech into a tiny wearable circuit. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Children can do more than watch films. They can learn how to produce them. That's according to Vanier Pettigrew, the founder of Root Branch Productions and Film Academy. 2 years ago, she started a program to teach elementary school students how to make a documentary, an initiative that could not happen without the support of an enthusiastic principal. Faiza El-Masri visited Lockerman Bundy Elementary School to learn more. Carol Pearson narrates.
This is the third year these children are taking part in a documentary filmmaking class.
You want to line the subject up.
3 times a week, they get together to brainstorm, tell stories, and write. They also learn the behind-the-scenes skills.
You want to always make sure you listen for the click. They're learning framing and composition and rule of thirds and all these other kind of technical things. They're learning how to set up the camera, how to use the camera, how to use the audio equipment.
Along the way, they are learning important life skills.
What is one thing you wish people understood about you?
So I really play a lot.
We really find the value in teaching documentary style because, as I simply put it, documentaries are real people talking about real issues. So this is an opportunity for them to have voice as a young person, to exercise youth voice, to be able to advocate for themselves.
My name
Youth
is
Truth was the group's first project.
I am in the fourth grade, and today my topic will be about how it's people killing other people.
I just listen to these, you know, these children express themselves.
You want
to
know what I'm tired of?
They talked about all the different things that they were tired of. They were tired of, like I said, people being mistreated by the police. They were tired of violence in their neighborhood. That film had gone on to be screened at the youth segment of the Maryland Film Festival here in Baltimore. It won the Audience Choice Awards at the Born in Baltimore Film Festival.
Last year, the group produced iReady, a song about standardized testing that's now being shown in schools in Baltimore City. The lyrics were written by school principal Kimberly Hill Miller. She's a big supporter of the filmmaking class, which she says gives students a chance to develop speaking and listening skills.
I am noticing that students are able to communicate better than they did before, prior to the program. They are participating. They are showing respect to one another, giving each other eye contact when they are engaged in discussions in class.
Quiet on the set.
Today's project involves self-reflection and communication with classmates.
Sometimes they misunderstand me. Like I said, when I say stop, they take that as an assault. But I'm a loving and kind person. I really am.
It might really help us express what we want to do. You could do a lot of other things if you try them. It mostly gives me confidence.
Confidence, teamwork, and creativity. Skills that will help these kids become filmmakers or anything else they want to become. For writer Faiza El-Masri in Baltimore, Maryland.
Nice and slow.
Carol Pearson. VOA News.
Myanmar's military said last Friday 6 Rohingya Muslims killed and 9 wounded in an aerial attack in the western state of Rakhine this week were affiliated with an armed rebel group. The army-run Miawadi newspaper said the villagers were together with terrorists while the army was cracking down on the Arakan army's terrorist activities on Wednesday. Ravina Shamdasani is a spokeswoman for the UN High Commissioner for the Human Rights and first revealed to VOA Asia's Ira Melman that the original death toll of 7 people in a helicopter attack in western Myanmar last week has risen. She says there is a growing evidence it could be that some 30 people were killed by the Myanmar Army helicopter attack.
We had issued a report on Friday saying that we understand that at least 7 Rohingya Muslims had been killed in a helicopter attack by the Tatmadaw, the military of Myanmar. We are now receiving reports that the number may be much higher than that. We have unconfirmed reports that the number may be even as high as 30 who are unaccounted for. In response, we understand that a military spokesperson has said that these were terrorists who were supporting the Arakan army. We reject that accusation and we ask the government of Myanmar and the Tatmadaw to ensure that civilians are not targeted and that heavy artillery is not used in civilian areas on the pretext of national security. We are calling on both sides to cease hostilities and to respect international human rights and international humanitarian law. The Tatmadaw, the army of Myanmar, has reacted to the attacks by the Arakan army with excessive force. We are now seeing, since the 3rd of April, the use of helicopters in civilian areas. The Arakan army, on their part, we understand that the fighting has now moved from the hills, where it had begun, down to the urban areas, and residential areas are being used by the Arakan army, putting civilians' lives at risk. We've also heard that the Arakan army has been targeting public administration officials and police, and that there have been targeted killings even. So we're calling on both sides to, first of all, cease the hostilities, and if hostilities are carried out, to spare civilians, to ensure the protection of civilians.
Why has there been such a resurgence in violence after so many people, so many Rohingya were forced to cross into Bangladesh?
So what's very important is to ensure that people understand the distinction between this, the Arakan army, and the Rohingya issue. This Arakan army was established 10 years ago, and their objective was to create a state of their own, a Buddhist ethnic Rakhine state. This is a completely distinct group from the Rohingya Muslims. So this is actually completely unrelated to the exodus of the Rohingya Muslims. It's very important to have that distinction because there's often a misunderstanding that this Arakan army is composed of Rohingya Muslims when it couldn't be further from the truth. In fact, there has been a lot of reports of the Arakan army as well targeting the Rohingya Muslims. The resurgence, there was an attack in January by the Arakan army against several police border posts the government of Myanmar. The Tatmadaw, which is the army of Myanmar, then responded with strong force and received orders from the government of Myanmar to crush the Arakan army. This led to a resurgence in clashes, which has only increased in recent weeks.
So what in reality can you do, can the UN do, besides to plea for an end to the violence?
We do not have access, unfortunately, to Myanmar, in spite of repeated requests. But what is important is that we're putting the news out there. Even if we do not have access, the fact that civilians are suffering, the fact that civilians are dying, should not simply go unnoticed. We need to raise international attention and international concern on this. We need to assure the government of Myanmar, the Tatmadaw, and the Arakan army that the international community is watching and is willing and keen to hold accountable the perpetrators of this violence against civilians. The people must not be allowed to suffer in silence.
What is it about Myanmar that even a leader like Aung San Suu Kyi can't seem to lead her country to peace?
Unfortunately, we have found that the leadership in Myanmar has failed in an abominable way. There has been, far from an attempt to actually address the violations that have taken place, the very serious human rights violations that have taken place, there is often a blanket denial that anything is wrong. Even when 1 million Rohingya Muslims fled the country, there was a denial of the systematic discrimination, the institutionalized discrimination, and the violence that they had been facing over decades. Even now, there seems to be a denial that anything is wrong. The government of Myanmar is insisting that the conditions are there for the Rohingya Muslims to return to the country. I mean, this is completely untrue, patently untrue. And we are very disappointed that the continued reaction of the government of Myanmar seems to be denial and a continuation of the violations and of impunity.
Shamdasani said the government of Myanmar must be held accountable and responsible for what it has done to its own people.
The Voice of America. VOA.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. The UN Refugee Agency and partners are scaling up emergency preparations to help hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees withstand a second monsoon season in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR's headquarters in Geneva.
Heavy rains are expected to fall in a few weeks. Aid agencies are racing to shore up flimsy shelters and stabilize shaky terrain before the monsoon season begins. The UN Refugee Agency says the work ahead is monumental, but preparations are off to a better start this year than last. Aid agencies last year had to deal with a massive influx of more than 740,000 Rohingya refugees fleeing violence and persecution in Myanmar. They arrived over a period of a few months, straining local resources and requiring vast amounts of humanitarian assistance. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahecic tells VOA, "There is a clear danger of this untenable situation becoming an emergency within an emergency if the vulnerable campsite is hit by a cyclone or torrential rains."
Thanks to the mitigating work that has been done, and there was some heavy engineering work in terms of flattening of the land, flattening of the hills. A lot of the work has also gone into shoring up the steep hills to prevent the landslides. We've also moved more than 26,000 refugees to safer locations.
Mahecic says all the mitigating work has paid off. He says the refugee settlement made it through last year's monsoon season without any major incidents or substantial loss of life.
There are assessments that if the camps were to be hit frontally by a cyclone, that possibly up to 70% of the shelters would be destroyed.
Besides strengthening camp infrastructure, Mahecic says Rohingya refugees are being trained as first responders ahead of the cyclone. He says aid workers are going from house to house to inform people about the safety measures they need to take to better protect themselves from the monsoon. During the monsoons, he says volunteer first responders will tell families how to prevent the spread of disease and will offer counseling in case of need. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In rare public comments, Australia's spy chief has said his nation faces a list of security threats that is almost endless and greater than ever before. From Sydney, Phil Mercer tells us more.
Nick Warner is the head of Australia's newly created Office of National Intelligence, which aims to coordinate the work of the country's security agencies. Warner says Australia is confronting between 90 or 100 current security risks. They include threats from terrorism, both right-wing and Islamist extremism, tensions between China and the United States, regional unrest, and North Korea's nuclear program. There is a warning that territorial disputes and a trade war between Beijing and Washington will have an effect on Australia, which has close military ties to the US, but has relied on commerce with China for its recent prosperity. There are concerns, too, that the defeat of the group calling itself Islamic State in Syria could mean that foreign Islamic militants could return home to Europe, as well as Australia and Southeast Asia. At least 30 Australians are reportedly housed at a refugee camp in Syria following the fall of the ISIS stronghold in the town of Baghouz. Warner says Australia's intelligence community is facing unparalleled challenges.
Australia's strategic environment is changing quickly and significantly. Australia is facing some of the most challenging strategic circumstances that it has for decades. The world is more complex, and arguably the world is more dangerous than it was. I could give you an almost endless list of challenges.
Closer to home, Warner sees emerging challenges with Australia's nearest neighbour, Papua New Guinea. Its population of 7 million people is expected to soar to 20 million in the next two decades, putting immense stress on natural resources such as water and also electricity supplies. Australia has 10 intelligence agencies. Its national terrorism threat level is at probable. It indicates that individuals or groups have the intent and capability to carry out an attack in Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
No security threat to Australia, but rather a welcomed visitor. A Dutchman climbed into his electric car 3 years ago and set off on a journey to the land down under. Last Sunday, a motorcade of electric vehicles escorted him and his converted Volkswagen across an iconic bridge as he finished his record-setting adventure. VOA's Arash Arabasadi plugs us into the ride along.
Sunday in Australia, an epic journey of 95,000 kilometers rolled to an end.
Since March 2016, I've been driving from Amsterdam to Sydney in a fully electric car and without any money.
Dutch adventurer Wiebe Walker drove a 2009 Volkswagen Golf. He named it the Blue Bandit, and together, with help from online donations, they made history.
I asked people to help me out, sign up to my website, and support me by offering a meal, place to sleep, or electricity for the car.
The dynamic duo set a record for the longest recorded trip in an electric car. Walker says his course was plotted by the help he received from people online, and the trip gave him the chance to prove wrong some critics.
My goal with this trip has been to show people the advantages of electric mobility, but a lot of people didn't want to start driving electric because there are a lot of prejudices. People think they're not reliable or you cannot cover long distances. So I thought I want to do something which is kind of insane as driving from Amsterdam to literally the other side of the world to basically show that it can be done.
Walker and the Bandit drove 1,119 days, more than 3 years, through 33 countries and nearly 100,000 kilometers. The journey that started in March 2016 came to an end Sunday. Walker says the drive was to inspire and educate about a carbon-free future. Bad news for would-be shoppers of his car, though. Walker says Blue Bandit is one of only 50 such electrics ever made. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Public health authorities are coping with outbreaks of measles in communities where vaccination rates are low. In the United States, this is fueled by a growing movement of people who view vaccines as dangerous. Mike O'Sullivan reports that the battle is being fought on the internet and in state legislatures.
While measles persists in other parts of the world, mostly because of a lack of resources to vaccinate people, in the United States, a growing number of people are reluctant to vaccinate their children because they fear it's dangerous.
And we have growing pockets of susceptibility, so that when we do have someone travel from New York to Israel or from Europe to Disneyland or whatever you envision, we have the opportunity for much larger outbreaks.
There are now measles cases in 15 states, including outbreaks in Washington and New York. California, Mississippi, and West Virginia do not allow exemptions from vaccinations, except for medical reasons. 47 states allow exemptions.
Of those 47, there are 18 that also allow non-medical exemptions for reasons of personal or philosophical beliefs, and that's where the battleground is.
Most people recover from measles, but in the United States, one in 1,000 who contract the disease will die. The anti-vaccine movement gained momentum when a 1998 study, later retracted, linked autism to the MMR vaccine that inoculates against measles, mumps, and rubella, giving ammunition to critics.
Like other vaccines, it's not required to be safety tested.
But public health agencies and major medical organizations say after decades of use, the MMR vaccine has been proven safe and highly effective. The autism link has been repeatedly disproven, says vaccine researcher Dr. Peter Hotez, whose daughter has autism. He says misinformation is spread on social media with messages targeted by region.
So with Texas, they see the soft underbelly being the far political right, the Tea Party, and they use Tea Party language. up in the Pacific Northwest and Washington State or Oregon that might use language of the far left.
Medical experts say the vaccine is essential to public health because measles is highly contagious.
Even if you don't share the room with the person at the same time, the virus can remain in the air for at least a couple of hours,
infecting anyone who is susceptible and potentially causing deadly outbreaks like many underway around the world. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Farmers on the Midwest should be preparing for planting season this spring, but instead, they are dealing with flood water, mud, and cleanup. In March, melting snow combined with a bomb cyclone storm caused historic flooding in fields and communities across the Midwest. One farmer in Nebraska says it may take years for his farm to get back to normal. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has a story.
Still in the days, I guess I'm still absorbing all the loss that we have. It's going to take a while before I can get it all understood.
This is what the flood left behind, a mess in the fields and a house unlivable.
Water was right up to here. We tore all the carpeting out, but too bad the foundation had to give away on the south side.
Tom Geisler said in 10 minutes,
that's where it caved out.
The water filled up his basement and crept into his 134-year-old farmhouse. Farming has been in Geisler's family for five generations.
This used to be my great-grandfather's place, but he lost it a long time ago, and then it's been resold and sold two other times. And I finally bought it back in 1982.
Geisler farms corn, soybeans, hay, and cattle. During the worst of the flood, he remembers helplessly hearing his calves, just recently born.
Bawling all night, yeah, that just about made his heart broken. But they survived. I thought they'd be gone. Couldn't even get to my calves. It was 5 foot deep out there. I couldn't feed them. Two calves are completely gone. They floated away, and two cows died.
He worries what the stress will do to the rest of his cattle, who had been standing in ice-cold water. As for his land, some areas have sand deposits from the river that he'll have to scrape and remove after the land dries up, before he can start planting, late in the growing season this spring.
I've been farming for 43 years. We lived on this place for 32 years since I've been married my wife, Frances. Never had anything like this before. My mother's been in her place all of her life, and she's 90 years old, and she's never seen anything like it either.
Getting to his mother's house a mile away has not been easy. The water left behind so much topsoil, now mud, that Geisler either walks in or drives a tractor to get there and feed the cattle.
There's always been resilient, so hopefully we can come back and farm some more. You know, I'm the fifth generation of farmers, so hopefully we can continue that trend. I don't want to give up. Sometimes you feel like it, but I don't want to. Sometimes it takes a toll on you, mentally and physically.
Geisler's younger son will follow in his footsteps. With some help and better weather, Geisler can start rebuilding his life. But he says it'll take 2 years or longer for his farm to recover. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Hooper, Nebraska.
The Voice of America. VOA.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. In India's elections that began Thursday, Prime Minister Narendra Modi hopes to return to power as he projects himself as a strong nationalist leader who will carry forward the country's development. On the campaign trail, Modi has steered clear of more contentious issues such as rising unemployment and rural distress. Reporter Anjana Pashricha spoke with voters in Uttar Pradesh in northern India, the country's most populous state, which has the largest parliamentary representation and is key to holding power in India.
Harvesting his sugarcane crop in Sonda village, this farmer recalls the promises made by Prime Minister Narendra Modi when he rode a populist wave to victory 5 years ago.
He has shown us many false dreams. He promised to double prices for our produce. We never got anything.
Despite being disillusioned, he still plans to cast his vote for Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party because he sees no viable option. Growing rural discontent due to plunging farm incomes is blamed for electoral setbacks for the BJP in three state elections in December. But the party hopes a recent measure to give $85 annually to farmers with small plots will revive support. It has promised to expand the cash handouts to all farmers. The payments have pleased those who have already gotten their first installment.
At least we will be able to pay for fertilizers and water. Before, what I earned was spent on paying for inputs like these.
In the city of Meerut, where Modi launched his 2019 campaign, many like Siddharth Vats are fired up by the leader who ordered airstrikes on what India said was a militant camp inside Pakistan in February.
There is improvement in India. Our economy is developing. During recent hostilities with Pakistan, he took a tough stand. This is happening only because of Modi.
But others question his record. Mujahid Mansuri worries about rising sectarian violence by cow vigilantes targeting Muslims and feels that Modi failed to live up to his 2014 pledge to create more jobs.
We need food on our table for our family. We need jobs. We don't want anything to do with a polarized environment.
In these towns and villages, there is support for Modi. The latest poll predicts he will win 50 out of the state's 80 parliamentary seats, still nothing like the 71 seats he captured in 2014. An alliance between two powerful regional parties in Uttar Pradesh has made the contest tougher, but political analysts say the BJP hopes to ride back to power on Modi's image.
Whether he gets a majority is the question mark. But yes, there are people who want to give him another term and more time because they look at him as a person who can deliver, a strong leader, a leader able to take risks. So let's see. But it's a very polarized country today.
The direction that voters swing in big heartland states like Uttar Pradesh will determine the outcome of India's election. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Uttar Pradesh.
Asia Weekend continues. Venom from a dangerous spider could give stroke patients a better chance of survival, according to Australian biochemists. They have found that a neurotoxin secreted by the Fraser Island funnel web spider contains a molecule that stalls the effects a stroke has on the brain. From Sydney, Australia, Phil Mercer reports.
A bite from the Fraser Island funnel web spider can kill a person in 15 minutes, but its venom could be life-saving and used to develop a drug to prevent brain damage. Scientists say the toxins can shut off a pathway in the brain that triggers the widespread death of cells after a stroke. Researchers at the University of Queensland believe it's a breakthrough that could protect stroke patients while they're being taken to hospital. Doctors often talk about a 4.5-hour window to give proper care and drugs to stroke patients. Those who live a long way from a hospital can suffer the consequences. The research team believes a drug developed from spider venom could be administered immediately by paramedics, protecting patients from further brain damage following a stroke. Professor Glenn King is the lead scientist.
The brain becomes acidic, and it turns out there's this little ion channel sitting on your neurons called acid-sensing ion channel, which senses this decrease in pH. It turns on and it sets off a cell death pathway for reasons we don't understand, and your neurons begin to die. And so what we found in the venom of the Fraser Island funnel web spider is the best known inhibitor of that channel. And if you inhibit that channel, you prevent the neurons dying. So we can't stop neurons that have already died, but we've shown that you can give this drug up to 8 hours after the stroke and still get really massive protection of the brain.
The Fraser Island funnel web spider is unique to the Australian state of Queensland. It lives in burrows beneath soil and sand. Clinical trials are some way off, but the team says that experiments with rodents have been successful. The World Health Organization says that stroke is the second leading cause of death globally and the third leading cause of disability. In Australia, it's estimated that 56,000 people suffer a new or recurrent stroke each year. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thanks for tuning in to VOA Asia Weekend. European Union leaders attending a summit in Brussels signaled progress Tuesday in creating a fairer playing field for trade and investment with China. The stakes are high for both sides. The EU is China's largest trading partner, while China is the EU's second biggest export market after the United States. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from Paris.
Speaking to reporters after talks with Chinese Premier Li Keqiang, European Union President Donald Tusk said China had agreed to address a key sticking point, concerns about industrial subsidies that critics say give Chinese businesses an unfair advantage.
It is a breakthrough. For the first time, China has agreed to engage with Europe on this key priority for WTO reform.
Premier Li told reporters that China supported fair competition, was committed to working within the framework of the World Trade Organization, and was strongly against industrial espionage. But he also said European companies could expect fair treatment in China.
We will not treat EU companies, especially those registered in China, with discriminatory policy, including solely foreign-owned companies in China. And likewise, Chinese companies should not be discriminated against in their operation in the European Union.
The EU-China summit is an annual meeting. This one, however, came amid heightened tensions over Chinese dominance of key European markets, perceived barriers for European investment in China, and security and privacy concerns regarding Chinese telecommunications company Huawei, which are shared by the United States. The EU is also split over how to deal with China. Last month, Italy became the first G7 member to join China's global Belt and Road infrastructure project. On Thursday, Premier Li holds another meeting in Croatia with Central and Eastern European states. Last month, French President Emmanuel Macron warned that China aimed to deepen European divisions and said the time for naivete was over. Europe has previously accused China of failing to follow talk with action. It may have been reflected in European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker's cautious assessment about this latest meeting.
Today's summit is a big step in the right direction. But commitments are only worth anything if we deliver on them. And that is what we must do in the weeks and months ahead.
The EU and China have also emphasized key areas of agreement, such as fighting climate change and supporting the Iran nuclear deal, which are in opposition to Trump administration policies. For VOA, I'm Lisa Bryant in Paris.
The Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. New leadership comes to the World Bank, while handmade crafts are keeping some women in India employed, as we hear in today's VOA Asia Business Scene from Skylar Ogden.
The World Bank Group has a new president. David Malpass begins his five-year term this week, succeeding Jim Yong Kim, who stepped down in February. The bank's mission is to reduce poverty and provide financial aid for needy countries. It is collectively owned by around 200 countries. Malpass has been a critic of the institution in the past, saying the bank is too big and that multilateralism has damaged the United States. He has also called for a reduction of lending to China, which he says is wealthy enough already. China is the World Bank's third largest shareholder after Japan, with about a 4.5% share of voting power. The largest shareholder at 16% is the United States, which typically nominates the bank's president. Trump nominated Malpass in February, choosing a loyal supporter who served in the administration as the Treasurer's Undersecretary of International Affairs. Critics have voiced concern that he will use the World Bank as an outlet to push Trump's America First agenda, but Malpass has pushed back in response, citing his work as lead negotiator in securing a $13 billion capital increase for the bank last year. Analysts say he has also softened his criticism of the bank in recent months. A group of women in India's northern Kashmir district are becoming well-known for their handcraft crocheted items. Former graphic designer Binish Khan launched an online craft shop, Crafts World Kashmir, And through it, she's been able to train and provide jobs for a small group of Kashmiri women. Binish Khan.
Response has always been positive. So because of that, we saw that the business is growing and there is a demand for it. After that, a lot of people came and said they want to learn as well. They asked us to show the way it's done.
India has access to many raw materials such as cotton, wool, and silk. It has long held a rich and varied textile tradition, with the Kashmir region being well known for handloom items that women traditionally created at home in their free time. Hannah Bhatt is a crocheter.
This is a very good step for us, especially for girls, for the ones who are sitting at home, the ones who do not have anything to do, the ones who are poor, or the ones who are not getting a job. For those people, it is really good.
Binish Khan hopes to train more boys and girls in the future so that more Kashmiri youth can get employment opportunities. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
Underneath the city of Los Angeles, workers expanding the city's subway system have uncovered a huge collection of Ice Age fossils. VOA's Kevin Enox unearths details of the latest finds.
This huge collection of fossils was found underneath the streets of Los Angeles. Underneath Wilshire Boulevard, to be exact, where workers are excavating an extension of the city subway. The fossils were saved thanks to strict California laws requiring paleontologists to be part of any extensive excavations.
Well, we're incredibly lucky that in California there is such strict mitigation, so that there is requirement for there to be a paleontologist anytime you're digging in native soils. That way, any fossil or artifact that peeks out of that dirt is seen immediately and can be saved. These laws don't exist everywhere, and so fossils are probably being lost all the time.
Some of the most interesting discoveries include a well-preserved skull from a mammoth nicknamed Hayden. Here is the skull of a giant sloth, and vertebrae and bones from giant saber-toothed cats and dire wolves. Stopping work to dig up fossils can be expensive, but LA official Dave Sotero says the paleontologists, the city, and the excavation contractors generally have figured out a way to get the fossils out of the ground and get the work done.
I think in California we have the distinction as having some of the most stringent environmental rules anywhere in the country and possibly the world. So it behooves us to work very closely with the paleontologist, to work very closely with the contractor, and develop a set of best practices that will help us preserve the fossil record but still get our project done.
The fossils provide a great look at this region 20, 30, and even 50,000 years ago. Paleontologist Emily Lindsay says they can teach us about some issues we are dealing with today.
Climate change, which is something that's, of course, of great interest to people today and was also something that the world was experiencing when most of these large animals went extinct, and also how human activities can impact ecosystems, because around the time that humans arrived in the Americas is also around the time when we see most of these big animals that people are so excited about finding here go extinct.
The new fossils will go on display at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. As for the new subway system, it will not be ready for passengers until 2027. Plenty of time to find more fossils. Kevin Enox, VOA News.
Climate change is among the most politically divisive issues in Washington. Some Democrats are backing a Green New Deal to transform the entire energy system in a decade. Republicans say these proposals would wreck the economy. While the federal government is at a stalemate, some states are taking action. VOA's Steve Barragona went to Massachusetts, where the clean energy workforce is growing.
It's minus 8 degrees Celsius in western Massachusetts. But the weather has not stopped the crew preparing this 8,000-panel solar farm.
For the rest of this week, it's going to be freezing cold.
Veteran electrician Ed Martell says installations have been going nonstop for the last several years.
I thought it was going to be a flash in the pan a couple years ago. I've seen solar just keep going and going and going.
Martell says the boom has been good for electricians like him. The industry has been growing at a time when he says there has not been much other work.
If it wasn't for solar, there would have been a 2-year period where I wouldn't have worked at all.
So yes, it's very good for us.
Massachusetts now ranks third nationwide in solar jobs, behind California and Florida. Renewable energy is just one way the state is dealing with global warming. In Washington, the climate debate is polarized between Democrats calling for an end to fossil fuels and Republicans saying these proposals will destroy jobs. But Massachusetts Republican Governor Charlie Baker took over from a Democrat and held firm on climate policy.
In Massachusetts, climate change is not a partisan issue. While we sometimes disagree on specific policies, we understand the science.
The state set a target back in 2008 to cut greenhouse gas emissions 80% by mid-century. It charges power companies for carbon pollution and sets policies that encourage efficiency and renewable energy. And the state has invested in new technology, like this wind turbine testing center outside Boston. It's paying off, according to Steve Pike, head of the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, an agency created to help the state meet its climate goals.
Over the course of the last 8 years, every single year, the number of employees, the number of workers in the clean energy industry has grown. And in total has grown since 2010 by 84%. So not only does investing in clean energy make good sense in terms of climate change, but it also makes economic sense for Massachusetts.
Clean energy is now a $13 billion industry here, employing 110,000 workers. The state's economy has grown more than 20% since 2000, while greenhouse gas emissions have fallen nearly 22%. Pike says fighting climate change does not have to mean wrecking the economy.
Certainly in Massachusetts, what we have found over the last 10 years is just the opposite. In fact, it grows the economy.
There's work to do to power the world without wrecking the climate. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Wales, Massachusetts.
You're still listening to VOA Asia Weekend. South Korea's top court is expected to respond soon to a petition asking it to declare the country's criminal ban on abortions unconstitutional. Voices are passionate on both sides of the debate, as Kurt Aitchen reports from Seoul.
These South Korean women hold a quiet daily vigil in front of the country's constitutional court in central Seoul. The court is set to rule this week on whether to uphold or overturn South Korea's criminalization of abortion. The women vehemently support keeping the ban in place.
We have been protesting here since June last year, so it's been more than 10 months now. We are not an organized group, but individually we come out here, hold petition campaigns, and work to spread the word via social media. Still, we have no way of knowing what the court decision will be.
Religious groups and conservatives support South Korea's current legal structure, in which a woman who terminates a pregnancy on her own with drugs or other measures can be sentenced to up to 1 year in prison or fined up to 2 million won, about $1,700. Doctors who facilitate an abortion could face up to 2 years in prison. Supporters of overturning the law and decriminalizing abortion are vocal, holding what have come to be known as red and black protests.
Red and black are symbolic colors. Koreans have worn black since 2010 to demand abortion rights in solidarity with similar protest groups in Poland and other countries. We also display red color to send a warning to the court that criminalization of abortion is against the Constitution, and we're calling on members of the court to rule to that effect.
The abortion debate is every bit as sensitive in South Korea as it is elsewhere, with all of the same moral and ethical dimensions other countries confront. But here, there is the added complication of a demographic crisis. The government is struggling to counter a plummeting birth rate stemming from a changing economy and from educated young women making new choices about their bodies, their careers, and their future. Supporters of overturning the abortion ban say the current law reflects a long-standing tone deafness by the government toward women and their right to self-determination. Women are not wombs is a common slogan at their events. It will take 6 of the 9 judges on South Korea's constitutional court to decide whether it's time for a change and whether criminalization of abortion should be relegated to the history books. Kurt Aitchen for VOA News, Seoul.
VOA.
We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. The live stream video of the Christchurch, New Zealand mosque shooting last month highlighted the continuing struggle by social media companies to police extremist content on their platforms. Facebook and Google representatives told U.S. lawmakers Tuesday the effort to balance free speech with oversight of white supremacist content is ongoing. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more from Capitol Hill.
A church, a synagogue, and a mosque. Attacks inspired by white supremacist ideology fostered on social media.
In the age of instant communication with worldwide reach, white nationalist groups target communities of color and religious minorities through social media platforms.
Since 2007, right-wing extremist attacks have taken place across the nation. But the problem is global, and the live stream of the New Zealand shooting posed a massive challenge.
We actually prevented 1.2 million and were able to find 300,000 additional uploads of that video within the first 24 hours and had a very forceful and swift response.
The decision to remove videos of mass shootings is clear-cut. Policing the free speech of more than 2 billion people is far more complex.
Hate speech, because it often relies on spoken rather than visual cues, is sometimes harder to detect than some forms of branded terrorist propaganda. It's intensely context-specific, and it can be contentious, as there is often disagreement on what could be considered political speech. On the opposite end, over-aggressive enforcement can also inadvertently silence voices that are using the platform to make themselves heard on these important issues.
Social media companies are protected by law from liability for content posted on their platforms.
This is a piece of legislation that really allows the internet as we understand it to exist. And fiddling with it on the edges could, I think, have a really bad implications for customers who enjoy using these services. Because what will happen is if they amend a legislation to actually make Facebook, Twitter, YouTube liable for extremist content, say, you run the risk of overreaction. And Facebook and Twitter will be they'll shut down tons and tons and tons of channels and content.
White supremacy has never been allowed on Facebook, but recently the company expanded the scope of the ban, redirecting users to a nonprofit that helps people leave hate groups.
We extended that policy to include a ban on all praise, support, and representation of white nationalism and white separatism. We see these ideologies as being inextricably linked to supremacy with intensive violence more generally.
President Trump's rhetoric about immigrants and his reaction in the aftermath of the deadly 2017 Charlottesville rally encourages hate speech, say Democrats. The president denies this, and the danger of white supremacy was acknowledged just last week by the nation's top law enforcement official.
We assess that it's a persistent, pervasive threat.
This just illustrates part of the problem.
A problem so immediate that racist content flooding the YouTube live stream of the hearing shut the comments section down. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. A Silicon Valley coding prodigy at 10, who's been coding since age 6, has created two new board games to teach other kids to code. VOA's Deanna Mitchell reports from Santa Clara, California.
Samira Mehta is not your average 10-year-old. She's been coding since age 6 and is into artificial intelligence. In fact, she's so passionate about these topics that she wants to share the love. She's created two board games in hopes that other kids, especially girls, will catch the tech bug.
Coder Bunnies, it will teach you all the concepts you ever need in computer programming. From the very basics like sequencing, conditionals, and debugging, to more advanced computer programming concepts, Coder Minds is the first artificial intelligence board game ever created. We're setting up by arranging them in piles.
Mehta was born into the tech world. Her dad, who works in artificial intelligence at Intel, first got her interested in coding when she was just 6 years old.
He showed me one button on his computer which said, "Press this if you're beautiful." But then when my mouse pointer touched the "You are beautiful" command, it just disappeared. I was like, "Wait, how did you do that?" And they got me really involved in coding.
I think there's a lot of passion and enthusiasm in this girl, and she wants to make a difference, and that is coming from the heart.
Mehta particularly hopes to inspire other girls.
And I believe that girls are underrepresented, especially in this computer science and technology field.
She has held coding workshops for kids at local libraries, Google, Microsoft, and Intel. Her ambitions have even gotten her face-to-face with Mark Zuckerberg, using a strategy only a kid could pull off.
I was actually handing out the candy on Halloween when we went to his house. So we talked for a little while.
She's already made more than $200,000 worldwide from her board games and has started a girls' initiative called Girls You Code. So what's next?
I like coding and I like artificial intelligence, and I want to use it to do good to others.
Seems like this trailblazer is on the right path. Dina Mitchell for VOA News, Santa Clara, California.
An international team of scientists gathered around the world Wednesday to simultaneously reveal the first ever picture of a black hole, a celestial body considered so dense, even light itself cannot escape its gravitational pull. Scientists in Washington joined colleagues in Brussels, Santiago, Shanghai, Taipei, and Tokyo to disclose the groundbreaking result from the Event Horizon Telescope Project, an international collaboration begun in 2012 to directly observe a black hole using a global network of telescopes and international cooperation of more than 200 researchers. Astrophysicist and Event Horizon Director Shepard Doleman unveiled the images in Washington. He said the picture is of a black hole at the center of a galaxy 55 million light years away. Doleman says being able to take a picture and observe a black hole allows scientists to confirm many things that up to now were only theories.
We now know that a black hole that weighs 6.5 billion times what our sun does exists in the center of M87. And this is the strongest evidence that we have to date for the existence of black holes. And it is also consistent, the shape of this shadow, to the precision of our measurements with Einstein's predictions. The bright patch in the south that you see tells us that material moving around the black hole is moving at light speeds, which is also consistent with our simulations and predictions.
Doleman said from the image, scientists are able to establish a clear link between supermassive black holes and the engines of bright galaxies. He said the images establish clearly that black holes drive large-scale structure of the universe from the center of these galaxies. Black holes are thought to evolve at the end of a lifetime of a star when it collapses in on itself to create a super-dense object with gravity so powerful that stars, planets, and even light itself cannot escape its pull. With this technology from the Event Horizon Telescope Project, Doleman said scientists now have a way to study black holes and their impact on the universe. A group of scientists is using technology used to study the stars in order to find endangered orangutans in the dense forests of Indonesia. As VOA's David Byrd reports, the heat-seeking drones are helping scientists keep track of the number of these endangered great apes.
According to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the number of Bornean orangutans has dropped by nearly two-thirds since the 1970s. Tracking the endangered animals can prove difficult since they build their nests in trees. The traditional method for counting them has been to count the nests from the ground, but the dense jungle foliage means that method is unreliable. Now, thanks to a collaboration between Liverpool's John Moores University, the Worldwide Fund for Nature, and the Hutan Conservation Project, scientists are using a new tool to find the great apes. Drones. These drones are equipped with thermal imaging cameras that are usually used for studying the luminosity of stars. Dr. Serge Witch of Liverpool John Moores University is an expert on primate behavioral ecology. He says he was skeptical that the drones would be able to detect the body heat signatures of orangs in the trees.
We've been extremely successful with detecting the orangutans in their nests from various heights. So we've learned a lot by those results.
The team made a total of 28 flights at two sites over 6 days and spotted 41 orangutans from the air. All of the observations were confirmed by scientists on the ground. Serge Witch says the flights were done early in the morning or after sundown in order to get the best results.
During the day, the temperature of the forest is quite similar to the temperatures of the bodies of mammals, so you can't detect warm-blooded animals that well. In the morning, it's best because the forest had all night to cool down, lose its heat, and then the animals really stand out and you can detect them very, very well.
Borneo's orangutans have been critically endangered since 2016. Their numbers have dropped dramatically since the 1970s, when large portions of their habitat were destroyed and replaced by oil palm plantations. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thank you for tuning in with us on VOA Asia Weekend. For Ira Melman, I'm Ari Arafin in Washington, D.C. Have a wonderful weekend. See you next week.